From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A new and terrifying wave of authoritarianism veering toward fascism has taken hold of the leadership in many nations today. From Donald Trump in the US to Boris Johnson in the UK, Narendra Modi in India, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, and many others, it seems as though the right is dangerously ascendant. My next guest is a historian who says that although today's right-wing radical movements are more moderate than those that were seen under classical fascism, there are dangerous similarities. David Renton is a barrister, historian, and anti-fascist activist. His earlier books include Fascism, Theory, and Practice. He now joins me to discuss his newest book called simply The New Authoritarians, Convergence on the Right. Welcome to the program, David.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sonali.
So you're joining me right now from the UK, where you have ended up with Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, although possibly not for very long since you have elections coming up. How do you view, or why do you view, I should say, the various new right-wing leaders as part of a trend rather than just, you know, individual instances where sometimes some leaders are right wing, some tilt left? Why do you see this as part of a global trend?
Well, one of the things I talk about in my book is the way in which these different leaders work together. They share resources, they share money, key propagandists go from country to country. Like Steve Bannon, for example. One of the processes I talk about is, say, the way that when Donald Trump was standing for election in 2016, he got an enormous amount of energy from the Brexit vote in Britain, then that powered him. Then after he'd become elected, obviously he's used his position as the president of the United States and this incredibly important figure right around the world to boost far-right leaders and parties all around the world. So, for example, in France, after Trump came in, the Front National got this enormous boost. They nearly won the presidential elections. And there are all sorts of other leaders. I mean, you mentioned Bolsonaro, for example. It's very hard to see how he'd won that election if it hadn't been what happened in the States and Trump's victory a couple of years beforehand.
So you're suggesting that there is a direct coordination in the leadership circles that these various leaders travel in. We certainly see in the United States, we see Trump directly boosting other dictatorial leaders or leaders that tend toward, you know, dictatorial tendencies. He seems to have rejected the more sort of liberal leaders of countries and embraced leaders like Vladimir Putin in Russia. He certainly seems to admire him, admires Xi Jinping, the North Korea's leader, and certainly Bolsonaro, Duterte in the Philippines, Saudi Arabia's leaders. He seems to have an affinity for others like him. But specifically in terms of coordination, you cited Steve Bannon. There's also Cambridge Analytica, these sort of digital tools that the right uses in various countries. Can you explore that a little further? How they directly coordinate, not just echoing one another in the public sphere, but actually behind the scenes coordinating with one another?
Well, I'm not sure if coordinate is quite the right word. The word I use in the title of my book is convergence. In other words, you've got a bunch of people who set off originally on their own individual directions, but find that their opportunities to advance their rule, that they just overlap, that people have the same interests, they have the same broad political approach. This influence goes both ways, that it's not as simple as just, you know, Trump backs people in other countries. It's also within the United States that he gets the support of people who take their lead from leaders outside. So for example, one of the few people you didn't mention just now was Modi. There's no doubt that the BJP in government in India has had an impact on Indian communities within the United States and encouraged people and organized people to turn out as supporters of Trump even before Trump was elected. So the word I use is convergence, and it's a bit looser. It's not the case that there's one evil genius sitting over this process and everyone's like playing puppets and he's the puppet master. You've seen people try and do that. I mean Steve Bannon, after he left the White House, he tried to play that role internationally, and actually he's largely failed to do that. So it's much more that people are in the same political space in different countries. They see people in outside their country who are succeeding with these politics, and they try and emulate and copy and influence. But it's not as simple as them like coordinating. They're kind of morphing and changing and becoming one global way of doing politics. But that's a process of sort of becoming, and we're not the whole way there yet.
Let's bring the historical framework into this. Here in the United States, with the family separation policy aimed at undocumented immigrants, we have seen these detention centers that have been labeled by those on the left as concentration camps, trying to link what Trump is doing to marginalized and vulnerable communities to using a very specific historical reference that Trump supporters have vehemently rejected. So how do you compare the movements that are emerging today with those that we saw, particularly, in the mid-1930s and 40s in Europe and what we think of as classical fascism?
Well, one of the things I'm trying to explain to people is that when classical fascism started in the 20s and 30s, it didn't start off as a bunch of people waking up one morning and saying, right, what we're going to do is we're going to turn the whole of Europe into a state of constant warfare. They didn't plan from the outset that they'd set up concentration camps within Europe. That there was a process which got to them, which got to that final point, and that process was relatively protracted. But one of the things which was going on in the 20s and 30s was just as today, a process whereby people were working, different right-wing groups were working with each other across borders. They were seeing one person breaking through in one country and trying to copy it. And there was a process of people who started off being kind of the center-right, the equivalent in the States of Republicans, becoming increasingly militant and radicalized over time. And it's that dynamic of people working together across borders, of incrementally moving ever further to the right. I think that's the real comparison between the interwar years and today. I think that's that dynamic, that process of copying and radicalizing is the same. Again, I don't think that today we've got as far as fascism. I have to admit, I'd be very cautious about describing what the terrible things which are happening to families who have been split up on the United States borders. I'd be really cautious about calling that concentration camps. It seems to me that if you say these things are concentration camps, you're saying that families are being put in them with the purpose of them, for them to be killed. And that to me seems an exaggeration. It telescopes a process. History right now is pointing in a really troubling an unpleasant direction, but that doesn't mean that we're right all the way to the end of that process yet, by any means.
Now, of course, we do see genocides continuing to play out in various parts of the world. We have the persecution of Rohingyas in Myanmar. There's very strong evidence that China is attempting to target, if not eradicate, its Muslim population. There are certainly those sorts of things that harken back to concentration camp type practices today. But let's talk about what it is that one thing that I'm very interested in is the links between the resurgent so-called neo-Nazi movements that we see on the ground and the leaders who sort of use dog whistle language to indicate to these neo-Nazis that they are on the same side as them. Here in the United States, President Trump has been accused of calling neo-Nazis, very fine people when the Charlottesville riots and gathering took place. And we've seen similar sort of indications in Europe as well. Can you analyze that a little bit, how those links are taking place between leaders and neo-Nazis on the ground?
Yeah, no. One of the things, again, which is troubling is that I've talked about links between leaders across country, but there's also a process whereby leaders, particularly Trump, but he's not the only one, have been giving backing to relatively marginal figures in these various countries and giving them a boost. If you think about, say, in the States, you might think about something like the Proud Boys, or in Britain, you might think about something like, we had a movement here, Britain First. For people who've watched Britain First a long time, we regard it as an organisation of about 20 people that seem to be going nowhere. And then lo and behold, next thing we see is that Donald Trump's retweeting their tweets, giving them enormous amount of publicity. And suddenly it feels to them they've been given the biggest boost they could possibly imagine. But again, as I said, it's not just Trump who's doing this, that, you know, another figure on the far right in Britain, and I could give you these examples from any country, but I'm just using Britain because it's easy. You know, we've got people on the far right. There's an individual, Tommy Robinson, who was jailed last year for contempt of court. This led to huge protests in Britain, the largest far right street movement we've had at any time in British history. But Tommy Robinson was receiving vast amount of support from within the states, from people, not Donald Trump himself, but members of his family. And he's also been receiving support for a number of years from other right-wing governments, for example, Russia, who spent an enormous amount of money on boosting his social media presence. So you've got a situation where these leaders of massive states seem to be deliberately cultivating relationships with far-right street movements, although those street movements beforehand were tiny. But that's the mechanism by which they can become much bigger and much more threatening.
Would you characterize the leaders that are emerging today, such as Trump and others, as fascist? Or would you maybe use the term neo-fascist?
Look, I don't think either of those are helpful. I think if you wander around looking for fascists, then the truth is that actually very few of these leaders are anything much like fascism at all. One of the things which gave fascism its murderous dynamic in the 1930s is that these were movements which emerged wholly outside the state. Sorry, wholly outside the state. They were moving outside the rich, outside the ruling classes of those countries. And they were movements of very much of dispossessed and outsider groups who then, when they were able to reach state power, had a vindictiveness and a sadism because of that outsider status. When you compare them to people like Trump, or you compare them to people like Putin, or compare them to people like Modi, they're all people that originated actually, or Bolsonaro, within quite serious and standard bits of the ruling class. You know, Trump's power base is actually the Republican Party. The people who vote Trump overwhelmingly are the same people that voted for the last few Republican presidents. So I think you can exaggerate this. I think you can say, we're already at a stage where there's something like fascism that's emerging. That's something I don't do in the book. But what I want people to start to, kind of the reason why I wrote it, is I want people to start thinking through maybe a language or a way of explaining something which, while it isn't fascism, on the other hand, has a violent, destructive, murderous characteristic to it. I mean, the example you gave of what's happening to the families on the borders of the United States, that's something which is a significant step rightwards in American politics. And almost every country in Europe, in Latin America, has had something like that process of change hard to the right over the last 2 or 3 years. We need a language to try and understand what's going on, to try and explain it.
Would you say then, when we think about the commonalities between these two leaders, that our contemporary definition of what racism is undergirds their policies?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, and that's true again for every single one of the countries I talk about. Obviously, it's true with Trump. You know, his campaign starts with attacks on Mexicans. It builds up to the whole rhetoric of the border wall. But this is a global phenomenon. If you look at Britain, the whole way in which Brexit has been cast is it's a mechanism to exclude foreigners, to build up our own border walls, to tax people, to make them pay extra for healthcare and so on, and to introduce all these sorts of punishments. It's exactly the same. You talk about the Front National in France, it's a tax on racial outsiders. You talk about the way in which border policies are changing all over Europe. Refugees being told that, you know, if they come into a country, they must give up even the few dollars they bring with them to come into a country. All these things are ratcheting up and getting worse, and definitely racism is a common theme to all of them.
What do you make of the analysis that these right-wing authoritarian leaders use racism and vulnerable communities of color as scapegoats to hide the true agenda, which is corporate domination, and that really we're talking about especially given that wealth inequality globally and within countries is reaching record levels, that really this is a way for the wealthiest elites to remain in power, who just benefit from having right-wing leaders who might, slam the poor immigrants while they give tax benefits to the wealthiest.
Look, I think that's a lot of what's going on, and I think that's as good as the place to start as any. But I wouldn't want to end there because, you know, if you think about it, world politics over the last 70 odd years, generally the rich have been in charge. So if you say, well, it's just about another mechanism for getting the rich to control things, well, that's right. But I don't know how much that really tells you. I mean, the way I'd put it maybe is a bit differently, that I think that between about, say, 1979, 1980, so the election of Thatcher in Britain, Reagan in the United States, from then till about 2015, 16, global politics was going in most countries more or less the same direction. And people call that neoliberalism. I'm sure that's a term that your listeners have heard a lot. It seems to me that either Trump's a turn away from neoliberalism, or he's a turn to a very different kind of neoliberalism, to the sorts of neoliberalism that was around 5 or 6 years ago. The short and medium term future is not the way that it was of sort of these international trade treaties, of a general trend towards free trade. We're seeing a turn towards protection. We're seeing a turn towards autarky. We're seeing a turn towards nationalism. Now, none of this is to glorify or prettify the neoliberalism that was going around 5 or 10 years ago. But it is to say, for example, that the epoch we're moving into is one where, for example, war is going to be much more common. Or maybe to give another example, which to me I think is really quite striking. You know, 10 years ago, when we talked about global ecocide and climate catastrophe, it seemed that the only discussion was really between people who were saying something's happening and, you know, we've got to stop it, and other people saying, well, maybe it's exaggerated. What we're now seeing with all these leaders, say, over climate change, is a whole different approach, which is to say, let the planet burn, let the Amazon burn. We really don't care. And almost laughing in the face of this sort of ecological disaster that they're setting everyone to. So, yes, it's the rule of the rich. Yes, it's the rule of the rich, using racism to kind of mask what it's really about. But it's also a new, more sadistic, more vindictive kind of right-wing rule, that's going to have all sorts of, terrible consequences for people in many, many countries.
In terms of leadership, the main bulwark against this right-wing trend is often seen as the liberal centrists. But really, as an anti-fascist, how do you like to see, or how would you like to see this resurgent right and dangerous right be defeated?
Look, it seems to me that wherever you are on the political spectrum, as long as you're not someone who associates with the right or the far right, there's the role for you to do. People can talk about, say, you mentioned Charlottesville. It seems to me that it's been incredibly important in American politics that the right, which turned out on the streets of Charlottesville, was confronted and opposed and defeated. And the people doing that stuff, that's an important part of what needs doing. But, you know, I'm calling in from Britain. Today, we're midway through our elections. Today, the Labour Party announced its manifesto. An opposition party which was extremely serious about wealth redistribution, which is promised in its manifesto, an absolute transformation about how we run the economy, about how we run housing, how we run benefits. And I think it's credible when it makes those promises. It's going to be really interesting in Britain to see how that's done. That's a left which is, in a sense, a bit closer to the mainstream than the Charlottesville left. It's more the equivalent, I don't know, Bernie Sanders or something like that in the States. But if that comes back and it achieves an election victory, say, against this very confident right we have here with the Conservatives, I think, again, that's something that would give heart to people in many different countries. So I don't want to say, look, there's only one way of doing it. You could be, you know, someone who considers yourself a complete opponent of the system. There are things which they can do. But there are also people who are a bit closer to the mainstream, the centre. You know, if they actually stand up for a radically different electoral politics, that, again, makes life easier for everyone, too.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. Good luck with the elections.
Thanks so much, Sonali. I've got everything crossed here, and I'll be out canvassing soon, too.
Thank you. My guest has been David Renton, barrister, historian, and anti-fascist activist. We've been talking about his latest book, The New Authoritarians: Convergence on the Right. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.